average graphic novel is bonkers.
So since Aiden's not here, I recommend this stuff for him. Down here we've got Kelly C. DeConnick. I think his fish tank cover speaks for itself.
Yeah.
Anyone here have a non-compliant tattoo?
Ideas that I had originally for different series that I've written when I get to a point where I realize that the natural evolution of the, you know, story during the writing process, where the idea no longer works, I no longer love the idea because it no longer works. I look at the idea and I don't like it anymore because it doesn't fit. So that becomes kind of easy, I think, to edit, to self-edit at that point. And as far as the drawing on, I have already lost it. It's already gone. It's done.
You said Teen Titans meet Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
Is there certain preconceived concepts, ideas, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that part is actually a little harder sometimes to let go of. When I enter a project with some preconceived notions of what I want it to be, mm-hmm. and I describe my series of that, and it's really only true for the first issue. After that,
yeah.
it becomes more of, you know, there's some homage to Love and Rockets. There's different things that really evolve out of it very quickly. And I fought with that one. Should I, the whole series be that same thing as the first issue? And I ultimately abandoned it and moved on to different directions.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I started working with Scott Godleski, we originally paired up to do a time travel book, and it was approved by Image, and it was just a matter of fleshing it out and making it work, and I never could. I could never crack it and get a version I liked. So I was like, I had this idea for a Western on an alien planet. What if we just did that? And the result is Copperhead. So, like, abandoning ideas can sometimes be a good thing. It can lead you to something more productive.
I was going to say, you really can't, you almost have no control on how your project morphs from the idea that you come up with and what you think, what you imagine, and what ultimately gets published are usually so drastically different that you really have no choice but to just, you know, make your peace with it and see where it goes. But occasionally you will have some specific idea that you thought was going to be so great and it just doesn't work and it doesn't fit, and that can be a bummer. But it really, you know, like you said, I mean, night and day, the things that you come up with, the things that you picture, your characters will not cooperate with that. your plot will not cooperate with that. Your story will be no part of what you imagined when you originally start.
But you don't need to abandon ideas. You just put them back on the shelf. Because if you have an idea that there's something about it you like, and you're building a story around it, and the story goes off in a new direction, as you were saying, and now the idea doesn't fit anymore, you take that idea out, and then later you stick it in another story, and you know it's yogurt style.
Yeah.
That I'm constantly doing stories that are some, you know, built on some idea I wanted to use 10, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, I've got an unannounced Image series coming up that is built on the story that was originally going to be Avengers Forever. But we had to abandon it and do a different story. And that first story sat in the back of my head going, I want to do this. I wanted to do it 10 years before we did Avengers Forever anyway. I still want to do it. I'm going to figure out a way to do it that doesn't require any Marvel characters. And now I've got, you know, a new thing that has gone off in a completely different direction. But ideas that you like are never done. You don't have to let go of them. You just save them for later.
It's very true, because that's where Madame Frankenstein came from. Was she's a character that I designed 10 years before Jamie and I ever wrote the book, and I was just going through my old sketchbooks and found her, and she resonated with me. So you really do not ever abandon anything. It's always floating around, and you can always repurpose it. So
I have a file on my desktop that's labeled Morgue, and that's where I don't have that experience of. When the idea doesn't work, I don't love it anymore. It has to be, like, pried from my hands, you know? But my experience with that is, usually if I'm being honest with myself, I want to include it because I think someone will think I'm clever. And if that's, and if that's like, if you realize, like, oh, I'm doing this to show off, or I'm doing this to show you how very clever I am, or I'm doing this to, like, hit you over the head with this connection, like, that really doesn't have a place in my book. And so I'll take that idea out, and I put it in the morgue. And the notion of the morgue is that I could come back to the shelf and pull those things off again, like, you know, to talk about Frankenstein, right? But I almost never do. Usually if they end up there, there's a reason. But somehow having that file so I don't ever actually have to hit delete, like, helps me fool myself into doing it.
Good question.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
zero editorial.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only exception, well, twofold, like I do a lot of work for Skybound, which is like a division of Image, and they do that, and in terms of the image itself, actually, and I think a couple of us have done this, I've actually hired an editor, because I actually like feedback, and I know it, because otherwise it's going to get into a back, I don't know, and like, you know, lucky David there, gosh, I'm both and everything, which thank you so much.
It's a surprisingly stressful job, but it's fun, because I just get to read comics. Anything that Image publishes, we publish because we want the creator to put it out there and have it be like their voice. Like Kelly Sue, didn't you, when you pitched Pitch Planet, wasn't it just like, hey, I have this series called Pitch Planet, and Eric was like, yes, we'll do that.
Yeah, he contacted me after Pretty Deadly came out and did kind of better than we expected it to do. He emailed and was like, I think we should talk about what comes next, and I was like, oh, you know, okay, I have this thing that I kind of want to do with the Valentine Delandro, and, you know, this working title is Bitch Planet. And and he wrote back a single line, I would very much like to publish something called Bitch Planet. And then that was it. That was sort of like, yes, do that thing. So.
Yeah, I had dinner with Eric couple years ago, and he was interested in me doing stuff for Image, and I told him like seven different series ideas I wanted to do, and when I was finished, I said, so are there any of those you'd like to do? And he said, all of them.
When I pitched to Eric last, I waited to make sure until he was texting. And then said, so would he be interested? And he's like, yeah, sure.
My very first Image book pitch, like 10 years ago, my first book, NYC Mech, I showed, it was when Jim Valentino was publisher, and I showed him just a collection of pages, and he saw these two robots that were doing drugs. And he said, I'd like to do, literally, this was the entire pitch, I'd like to do drugs with some robots. And that's how I got accepted.
Tweet that. Yes.
So if you can't tell, we're down for whatever. We publish sex criminals, and sex castles. So there you go. We'll live for it. Okay. And that actually ties into the theme of the panel, which is something for everybody. I have questions that we're going to dive into that, blah, blah, blah. But essentially, like if you look at the books that everyone on this panel does, like there are a couple Westerns, but they're two totally different tones, two totally different approaches. Joe Shudder is like, Tintin, Indiana Jones, plus it's Jim Starlin stuff, I guess. The fun of being an Image, of reading Image comics, I think the entire package is that what you see is what the creator wants to do. Like, that's the fundamental thing. It's creator-owned comics, the creator makes all the decisions, they make all the choices. Those are sentiments. I told you I was tired. But that's why, you know, these comics connect with you so closely, is that you can feel the creator's pride and emotional honesty.
Yeah, down to the paper stock, literally.
Yeah.
We got sent samples. They had to send samples of the paper stock that we were using. The price was changing, and so we had to make the decision as to whether we wanted to pay more or change to a different stock. And samples got sent to Emma in Spain and me in Portland. And you know, like we're on Skype talking about the pay. Like it's very like you can make as many decisions as you want. I had to price out. We have one line of fluoro text on a cover, and turns out like you have to buy the whole thing of ink because they don't like they don't stock that fluorescent ink. So like, oh, I was like, this was a part of the process I'm learning. Like, oh, okay, how much does ink cost?
Yeah,
you know.
There's little things like that are the things I've really learned to appreciate, like ad placement.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Or like, no, we're not gonna run ads. When it came with that Shudder, I was like, wait, I can just like put comics in here or like whatever, you know? Like, yeah, like and the paper stock thing, especially when we got that package, spent like hours just like laying and just pouring over like the little details of it, slightly
closer, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Whatever.
I know, and Emma has all these opinions, and I'm like that, like the guy that I'm like, I don't know, it fucking tastes like salt. I don't, you know, like the well, this is Himalayan salt, and this is Hawaiian pink salt. It all tastes like salt. But like, you know, Emma is very, like, so I just deferred to her. I was like, okay, kind of feel like paper to me.
They just asked me, they said, is this type of paper okay? It's what we use on Saga. And I was like, if it's okay for Saga, it's okay for me.
Yeah, it's not like you don't get any feedback from the image.
Yeah.
It's that you get to make the choice.
Yeah.
So, you know, we needed to retitle Tooth and Claw, and I came up with a whole bunch of different titles, and was running them by Ben and Eric Stevenson and other people, and Eric was happy to answer the question, what do you think of this? But the answer to the question, which one do you think we should use, is we should use whichever one you like best. You know, I'll tell you what I think, but it's your book.
Mm-hmm. That's the trick. Our print manager, Meredith Wallace, is a workhorse. Like, she's the one who does all the estimates and sends the paper and organizes all that stuff. And it's such a small thing, like, you never think about it when you're, like, reading a comic, but, like, a paper saw counts. If it feels like cheap newsprint, it'll detract from the comic. And actually, it might literally detract from the comic if, like, the colors don't separate.
Yeah, but if that's what you want.
Yeah, it might improve the comic if that's what you want.
Also, I don't know if you guys know this, but newsprint is super expensive now because no one uses it anymore. It's the cheapest, crappiest paper. But you got a question for us?
Yeah, I'm probably building on the other two of mine. So I've probably discovered most of all your work under a different brand, and then now you're all on Image. And this is sort of leans towards Jeff, most. Like, how are you capable of doing, like, solid creation for Image, and then also working with Marvel and DC in your head and doing other stuff? I mean, it seems like all of you kind of do that, but right now I know that he's got three really big titles with three different angles. And it seems like Image kind of pushes that, like, all that go crazy, but you're going to be able to keep a schedule, or how you
guys do it? I don't know, I can only speak for myself. I've always been able to handle a lot of projects at once. It's how I kind of thrive. How I enjoy it, where I enjoy jumping from different things and working in different worlds. And, I get really far ahead on all my projects, so I can take a break on them if I need to. And, I don't know, I'm not sure what the question is exactly. But
how do you handle jumping between work for hire and create your own? Is it tough to schedule that sort of thing? Is it a different mind state that you have to drop into?
No, not really. I mean, if you're doing work for hire well, you shouldn't approach it any differently from your creator own stuff, I think. You know, you should bring as much of yourself as you can to it.
Anybody hear him?
Sorry, maybe my mic's not working.
Can we bring the mic up on the end? Cool. Who else? A lot of you work for different companies. Like, do you have the same experience as Jeff, where it's just a matter of just focusing and getting it done and shifting to the next project?
Yeah, I'm working on Buffy the Vampire Slayer right now, so on top of, you know,
cool.
Yeah, so I have my, like, weird little feminist period horror book from Image, and then I was simultaneously starting working on Buffy, and...
That actually makes sense to me.
It does, yeah. It does, though, it really does, but, you know, there's much more direction with Dark Horse, so whenever there would be, like, a lull waiting to get approvals, I could use that downtime to work on a creator-owned project, and... They kind of just stagger naturally for me, I find. Like, I just meet the deadlines that, you know, my more mainstream book will ask of me, and then I get to play around and kind of do my own thing with creator-owned stuff, so.
It's the two mics on the end of me.
Here we go. Yeah, we're trying to get some mic.
Okay.
I think we're allowing across
to be separate. Oh, no, we don't allow anything. We're trying to stay out of the way.
I was just going to say a quick thing about doing multiple books, just that often you get stuck in a book, too, and I think working on more than one thing allows you to just, when you're stuck on one thing, you can just move on to another thing. At least for me, that's...
Yeah, it's like a palate cleanser sometimes.
The only thing I had along those lines that of consequence I wanted to point out was when I've had an editor for one of my work for hire, like doing something for DC, and they come to me with some editorial direction where I've had to go, okay, that's really cool, but, and then I send them a file because I'm already doing that on a book that's coming out the same day for my Image book, so maybe we can do something else. And that's been the only kind of conflict I've ever had with that, between the two
cool
jobs.
In terms of, like, editorial differences. It's just like, I had this idea that's going to be awesome over here, so.
I write everything like I own it, you know? Occasionally, if I don't own it, someone will tell me no. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't actually happen as often as people imagine that it does, I think.
Right.
Yeah,
the editor has to tell you no all the time. They should have hired somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Most of the time, they want you to be you, you know? I would love the luxury of just being able to work on one project, though. I think just as a human, I'm not as I listen to Jeff. I get ahead enough that I can take up. Like, what is that like? You know, that is not my experience. I'm a really slow writer, and juggling multiple projects is something I'm still trying to figure out. But
yeah, I used to write 5 books a month, but then I got old and sick. And I still come up with enough ideas to fill 5 books a month, but I can't get the writing done. So that's my big problem in terms of juggling work. My eyes are bigger than my stomach.
And that's one thing we came up on, actually two other panels this weekend, is that making comics is a health cost as well. You can't just be, you know, nose to the drawing board 24/7. You have to have fun, otherwise it's not going to be fun for you to work anymore. Or you'll get run down and sick, so it's something to keep in mind when you're doing several projects at the same time. What do you got for us?
This is my first Comic-Con.
Hey, welcome! Did you see my book's title?
Have you ever had any ideas that are too outlandish or absurd that you have to self-censor? And second question, where do you draw inspiration from?
The first issue of Madame Frankenstein had a dead girl running around naked, so I don't know that there's anything that's too wild for...
Shudder has lions and zoot suits and stuff, so no one's saying anything about that. And I did a book called Lori with Sophie, and there's two people who punch each other at the same time and their hands explode, so it's no one said no to that.
Yeah, I called Eric with a question about, I had some concern about a sex scene, and he was very politely made fun of me, I think, really. But he was have you read Black Kiss too? And he was I don't think anything you're doing is going to be a problem. And I was okay. And then I sort of felt I need to step it up.
Have any of the other read Black Kiss too? All right, the creator himself refers to it as Phil, if that gives you but so for as far as inspiration, it's sort of a broad question, but what makes a story true to you, I think, is a good way to...
Right, do you just pull in stuff from the ether?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Some of us are probably getting ideas from just the conversation that's going on here. I wrote an entire issue of Astro City that was inspired by stories that Neil Gaiman has told over the years about his assistant. And I thought, I could take that and turn it into a superhero thing, and so I did. But any idea that makes you think, oh, what if, or how would that go, is inspiration.
You do a lot of blockbustery action stuff, I feel, between Viking and Drifter. How do you get to that point? What draws you to those kind of stories?
I don't know, Drifter. I guess there is a lot of action in Drifter. I don't know. I really don't have a specific conscious inclination. I tend to sit down with things and you know, I have a sense of the mood that I want to evoke or reach. But beyond that, you know, the stuff just sort of comes to me and I run with it. I think we all, not every single person, but I think a lot of us come from, even if we're doing more sort of indie stuff, we come from sort of genre preconceptions of there's always got to be a gun somewhere, that sort of thing. We're not, many of us are not anyway writing stories that's just about just normal everyday life. That
you come up with a starting point, or you're given a starting point, and you just build from that.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes you get a starting point. Sometimes I've built a story out of just wanting, no, I mean, you can build a story from any point. You can build a story based on, you know, I just like this title, and I want to build something that fits that title. I've literally, you know, just been listening to a song, and then it's, and like, it, you can really be inspired, at least I can, by almost anything.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question.
Well, the really cool thing about comic scripting as opposed to any other kind of scripting is the styles are as various as the creators. So there is no, whereas if you don't use Final Draft with a particular setting for your screenplay, no one will read it. Literally everyone on this stage that writes has a different scripting style. I, for instance, don't number dialogue in my scripts because I consider the dialogue when I turn it in as a sort of rough draft dialogue, and so I don't worry about numbering it, and it makes it a little faster for me. There are people who are like horrified by that, and there's little differences from as much as like whether you know you do it flush left or center it. It's wildly different. And then in the panel descriptions, it not only varies for different writers, but it also varies for different partnerships. So I script in a very different style for Emma Rios than I do for David Lopez than I do for Valentine DeLandro. Matt Fraction works with the twins on Casanova, and they always say that the first line of the panel description is for them and everything else is for him. So they just read the first line. It is wildly different depending on the partnership, depending on what that person needs from you or wants from you, whether it's an established universe or, like, if I'm describing that ridiculous kitchen in Avengers Tower where for some reason they've put the sink in the middle of the room, like, I know that the artist has a file that has that reference. I don't have to say, all right, for some dumb reason, there's a sink at a point in the middle of the room, you know, which I would have to, if I was going to do that in my creator-owned book, I'd have to, like, build that world for the artist and explain, you know, why someone would do that. But, there's a ton of variables that go into it. But if you're interested in seeing a variety of scripts, there is, what is it, Comic Script Archive? I think it's Comic Script Archive. If you Google that combination of words, you're going to find this database. But there is a database where you can download a ton of scripts. It's a really great thing to do to kind of see the different varieties. And another great thing to do, if this is something that you're interested in pursuing, is to take a comic that you love and try to reverse engineer it, produce the script that would have produced that comic, or try to write the same story for three different artists. Those are all like great exercises for kind of expanding how you think about the script writing process.
But one thing I'll add in terms of panel description, and I think that the twins there are focused on much of that. I got back in the 80s when I was starting out, I got copies of everybody's scripts. You know, if somebody left a script lying around, I'd make a copy of it so that I could study it. And the script that taught me the most was an unpublished Daredevil script by Frank Miller. And almost every panel, the first line of the panel description was the word on. You know, we're on a hand opening a door. We're on two guys carrying a big sheet of plate glass across the street. We're on this, we're on that. Tell us what we're looking at first.
Yeah.
And any supporting detail that needed to come in the panel came next. But the very first thing he told us, you know, told the artist was the story moment.
Yeah.
This is what we're looking at. And since comics are visual storytelling, I found that, you know, very useful to know. Start off with the focus of the panel. Everything else is secondary to what the focus of the panel is.
Yeah, and don't fall in love with your prose too. Yeah. Like, don't burden the artist with information that they really probably don't want or need. There was a, like, if it's additive, absolutely, but a dude once bragged to me for some reason that he had a 40-page script for an 8-page comic, and I was like, man, I would punch you, you know? Like, don't do that. Like, write a novel. If that's what you want to do, go write a novel. Don't make your artist shut up, yeah. You know?
I would have drawn right on that script and given it back to him.
There are sometimes when I'm writing a script, I'll have something in there. And I often, one of the artist of Danger Club, I've worked with him for 20 years, so there's a lot of shorthand I get away with him, whereas I'm working with somebody I've never met before, I feel I have to be more detailed. But if there's ever, I always kind of include a little bit of information of like, you're the artist, you have to draw this. So, you know, unless I specifically say this part is really important for a story point that hasn't come up yet, you know, there's some flexibility there. And I want to work with the artist in question. I want them to have some, you know, they should have more control in certain ways than I do at that stage because they have to execute it. So I just try, I think it's important to try to work in an open way with the artist. However you write the script, whatever way is comfortable for you to write the script, do it. But if it's really important, maybe you make a note, say, don't change this, let's talk about this if you are having any issue with this. Otherwise, let's hear what you have to say on the subject.
Right, tell the story.
Yeah.
Alan Moore is another guy who would write a 40-page script for an 8-page script.
I'd punch him, too.
Alan was the only guy where I got a copy of one of his scripts and I couldn't read it. You know, I'd start reading it and I'd be 4 pages in and I'd realize that we weren't halfway down page one yet. And the artists he was working with literally went over his scripts with multiple highlighters, different colors, so that they could say, this is visual, this is atmosphere, this is this. But every one of his scripts also started out with, if you got a better way to do it, go ahead.
There's a really famous anecdote about, I think it was something for From Hell, he spends like a page and a half, 2 pages describing a door, and then at the bottom of it says, but so-and-so's standing in front of it, so you're not going to see it anyway. which, I mean, honestly, if you're Alan Moore, okay, but you're not Alan Moore.
Don't do that.
I find myself doing that sort of thing. I mean, not in that kind of detail, but I'll describe a setting and then realize, I better tell Brent that we're not going to see this in this panel. I'm introducing the setting because we're going to be here for the next 3 pages.
Yeah, you know what I've started doing with that is, and like now we're just talking, but I've started doing, if I'm introducing a new scene or like world building in a way that doesn't specifically apply to that panel, but I want to get all of this information across, I've started doing it before the panel description under the page header. Uh-huh. So page one, okay, we're changing a scene and you know, here's where we are
and this is it.
We go to panel one on whatever.
Okay. I'm stealing right.
Theater scripting.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. Of a BA in drama from the University of Texas.
That actually works for what I was going to say, which is if you think of yourself as almost as a playwright, the artist is who ultimately is going to perform the comic. So the ultimate form of what readers are experiencing is basically the most influenced by what the artist is doing. So you really, what information you're giving is just whatever you feel like is going to inspire and hopefully lead that person to give the best performance they can.
Yeah. On the artist side of it, since I'm probably the person sitting here who hasn't written a single script, but on the art side of it, it's the scripts I got from Jamie Rich for Madame Frankenstein, there would be whole panels where all of the direction would be the moment after. Like, there'd be a panel where something horrible would happen and you'd describe it, and the next one would be like, the reaction. That's all he'd write for a panel. So you could pick whichever character you wanted reacting. The emotion was what he was trying to get across to me, rather than telling me how to set the stage. He would say, this is what this panel needs to feel. This is what the audience needs to feel from this panel. So do what you want with that. And that was very freeing, but also kept me from taking the focus away from where that story needed to go and where those characters needed to go. So,
with Copperhead, after seeing what Scott did with the first issue, which I wrote full script, I decided to write the second issue because I was really busy at the time, what they used to call Marvel style, which was just, I would just describe scenes, you know, pages 2 through 5, this happens, and just a short little paragraph, and let him break down panel by panel what happens and where the page turns are. And he's such a great storyteller that we've done every issue since like that. And it's in the trade paperback in the back, we print the plot for issue 2, and you can compare it to what he did. And it shows just how much a part of it he is. And I go back in after the fact and dialogue it, but there are times where I'm making up conversations based on what he drew. So it's a kind of a fun way to collaborate.
I want to build on Megan's point about the artist is the filter through which the audience sees the comic. For the entire panel, actually, how much do you consider the audience when you're creating the book? Is that, you have an idea, you're like, I want these people to like it. These people might not, but that would be cool too. Or are you just like, I like this, so I'm freaking doing it?
No offense, but not at all.
No.
I think it's impossible to put yourself in the head of another person and just, anything you come up with is just fiction anyway. You created a fiction.
And it's a distraction.
Right. So,
it's a distraction from what you need to do for the story.
That way lies madness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't do it. It's reverse engineering, and if you try to do it, if you're trying, zombies are hot right now, let's do a zombie. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, that's terrible.
If you do that, it comes across.
Yeah.
I want to do stories that I would like to read, and I desperately hope other people want to read them. But when I did Marvels with Alex Ross, we were both agreed no one was going to pay much attention to this. It's a story about a little old guy wandering around the Marvel Universe going, hey, look at that! And maybe the issue with the X-Men on the cover would sell okay. And that turned out to be the issue that had the lowest turnaround. And then at the same time, about years later, I did a run of Defenders with Eric Larson where we finished issue 1 and we just said, this is terrific. People are going to love this. The audience hated the book. So I don't know what the audience wants. I can't predict it. And if I can tell a story that I think is a good, engaging story, maybe they'll want to come along.
You only have access to your own taste.
That's
really the only thing you can 100% be sure how someone's going to react is to your own reaction.
That's what makes me really excited to be a part of Image. It's like, if you look at the quotes by everyone on this panel and their collaborators, and like, those are the only people, 2, 3, 4 people on Earth who could actually do those books. You know? Like, I'm a huge fan of the Burritos. It's like, no one else could capture, I was talking to her, and I think I was talking to you at one point about like the way she draws leaves.
Yeah.
Little details like that.
Like, the fact that she draws every fucking leaf on every tree. Yeah, there's that.
I have a Nick. I really like both Viking and Drifter, which are totally cool books, but they're both yours, if that makes sense. Like your DNA is each, even though they're completely have a different stuff. So I don't know, that's what gets me excited as like reader again.
And I think with Jeff and Dustin on Descender, whenever I ask Dustin, like, where did this series come from, he just says that you two were sitting in a room and you were like, hey, I like robots too. Let's do a robot comic in space. We love space. And then you're off with the races.
Yeah.
It's a cool thing.
It wasn't much more complicated than that. Yeah. But I do, aside from writing for myself, I do find that I write stuff that I know he's going to find.
Your mic is still down. Yeah. Is the J's on?
Yeah. I just try to write stuff for Dustin a lot of time that I know he'll have a lot of fun drawing too. You know, because if he has fun, the reader's going to have fun looking at it. We just write for each other, really. That's a good partnership. I don't really care. Because everyone here has a different opinion, a different way of perceiving things. If I tried to write for one person,
With Shudder, the person I do write for is Layla. Originally, it was like a super grounded book, and I saw her stuff, and I was like, no way. You can draw anything. Like, why not do it? And then, it became this thing like I never saw coming.
What do you got for us?
First off, I actually like Defenders Run.
You said you liked Defenders Run. Thank you. Tell Marvel the collective.
Actually, touching on what you guys just talked about. So, obviously, you each have your own individual properties. Would you ever consider turning them over
I said no.
But like with like go the route of the Image Founders, who obviously have turned their original properties over to other creators.
Larson hasn't.
Larson still plugged away. But yeah, would you ever consider doing something like that, or is that like no? That's my sandbox. Get the hell away.
Well, I can't see ourselves doing that, especially since it's a book like this. But I was talking to Robert Kirkman at one point about Invincible. He's like, yeah, I can't wait to get to the book where someone takes it over and like everyone hates that run or whatever. And, all the old stuff was better. And, I don't know. I think it's kind of a cool thing, but I don't know. Like, it doesn't. I can't really conceive that.
I got it. I gotta say, you know, I kind of went through something like that with a creator-owned comic I did back in like 1999 called Little Gloomy. We ended up getting that turned into a television show in France that we had nothing to do with, and I really don't. It means nothing to me. And some people have asked me that same question before, like, well, you know, it's your baby. It's like my baby grew up. If I want to do more comics with it, I'll do more comics with it. But I want to do other things. If somebody else wants to do something with it, and I like it or don't like it, it's really kind of irrelevant to me. I've moved on at that point.
Yeah. Also, TV is different.
True.
It's an adaptation. I mean, if I took Arrowsmith, which Carlos Pacheco and I did, and we were going to do a sequel to it, we'd want to be the ones to do a sequel. If somebody wants to make a movie out of it, we don't know how to make movies. So. We'd be happy to turn it over to somebody else to make a movie out of it. But what happens in the movie isn't going to affect what we can do in the comics. It's not going to be, now all of a sudden I'm sharing the story with somebody else. I've still got my story to tell, and you know, they can do an adaptation of it elsewhere.
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, even if it was a different comic, if I feel I'm done with the story, then and I don't have anything else I want to say with it, and somebody else does, then more power to them, you know. I'd be interested to see what they did. Maybe I'd like it, maybe I wouldn't. It can be weird when it can be a deeply personal story that somebody would be taking, but I don't know that I would really mind. I mean, if I'm done, and that's a big question, like, if I'm done.
Right.
There's not even, I mean, there's different situations for anything. I think I've had ideas where I've come up with an idea and I just didn't feel like I was the right person to write it. I thought I liked the idea. I thought I could make something out of it. So I teamed up with someone else that I thought had more of a voice for the sort of nuts and bolts for it, and they took it over. I think you can do. I mean, largely my brain doesn't always work that way, but occasionally, sure. I don't. I'm not a person who's written really things that would gravitate towards a 500 issue series. But if I did, then yeah, sure, maybe I could. I could pass the baton.
Bitch Planet has a built-in structure where there every third issue we have a guest artist and we do the backstory of a particular character, so that style makes sense, that style shift.
That's a really cool idea.
But we're also going to be doing some small backup comics that will run in the back eventually, and the first one has already been pitch to me, and that will be an entirely different artist and writer team building the world out a little bit. And the difference there is that, like, Val and I hear the pitch. I mean, you know, it's for them to write and draw. It has to make sense in our world. But we kind of like the idea of having other people telling other women's stories in those pages.
What's your costume, Rachel?
Yeah.
Or what's your question?
Oh. It's Sunday.
I'm almost home.
Okay. Okay, I was like standing in line so long and probably you're going to butt hole every day.
You did it!
With Copperhead, we particularly Scott and I would talk about that. Like, what are, because I like a good Western, but I'm not like a Western buff. Like, I'm not, my knowledge is not widespread. But so we sat down and really talked about, like, what are the cliches, what are the archetypes, what are the classic Western tropes, and what do we do with them? How do we subvert them, make them ours, you know, play against expectations? So it's a matter of doing that, of taking the character you think you know and doing something different with it. But so, yeah, I mean, we are aware that we're hitting some of those notes, but hopefully in an interesting way.
Kurt, in Autolands, you've got a bunch of magicians, for example, wizard-type characters. How conscious are you of trying to avoid being just like another Gandalf or whatever Mickey Mouse wizard guy?
The closest thing I've got to Gandalf is a 3-foot-tall lady warthog. I don't worry about tropes, because tropes are tropes because people recognize them in work. They see them come up again. I don't want to descend to stereotype or cliche because you know that feels lazy and it's been done before. You know, certainly we have a mighty hero in Autumnlands where we're subverting not only the audience expectations of a mighty hero, but the other characters in the series' expectations of what a mighty hero is. But I'm sure that we're fulfilling tropes in other ways. The character is developing as our sidekick character is a bull terrier for a reason. You know, he's a dog. Dogs are loyal. Dogs are friendly. You know that we're using audience expectations of what they see when they see that kind of design to build the character. But at the same time, we're also willing to undercut or defy that. But I don't think you can ever fully get away from tropes. If you look at my page in TV tropes, you'll see that I certainly haven't.
You have one, seriously?
Oh yeah, it's very long. It's an Astro City page, and it's even longer. Because I mean, TV tropes is just people who their particular thing is they'll define a trope and they'll look for examples of it, and they'll find them. You may not have intended it, but it's there. They'll find it for you. If you're telling a good story, if you're telling an honest story, if you're being, that's the best word, honest with your characters, and the characters are behaving like individuals, it doesn't matter if they're fulfilling a trope or not, because they're doing what they would do. If you're creating a bunch of cliche, formulaic characters, then they're going to be flat. So make the characters feel real, and what they do will matter more than whether they fit some pattern.
Thank you for the question. We're actually out of time. If you're in line right now, could you just stood up? You get comments if you're in line right now.